Okay, so I... I, at the university where I work, you know, the main building, when we got it in the mid-70s, was a condemned building. And we've been working on it ever since. And Amanda now is in charge of the work in the building. But it used to be that the students and the staff would take a week off, almost a week, every term, and just do drywalling and painting and carpentry, working on the building. It was just such a... I mean, the building was a mess. And one part got finished up on the very top. One part got finished in about 1976 or 7. And then there was a fire. And that's the part that burned off, the part that everybody, you know, that so much work had been done, so lovingly restored. And that was the part that... And so the insurance money helped, but it wasn't quite enough for everything. So there were charred beams up there for years and years. Nobody was really using the third floor. We called it the disaster wing. The top floor of Park Hall was the disaster wing. Until some student started studying Marxism, and he called it the opportunity wing. The disaster wing became the opportunity wing. And ultimately, that's what the sermon today is about. Disasters and opportunities. So it just seemed like there's so many natural disasters happening so powerfully, and so I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about them together. And I want to do it, I don't think I've ever done this before. It's not been a pressing issue in my head, climate change and consequent disasters. But I wanted to sort of wrestle through it a bit today. So what's up? We've got Harvey flooding, we got Irma blowing, we got Jose rising, we got Mexico quaking, we got the West Coast burning, we got Myanmar drowning, and really devastating with a potential genocide. And we got the internet raging. Have you noticed that there's a lot of social media buzz? Okay, and a lot of it is religious in nature. A lot of people are giving religious answers for why all of this trouble. What are some of the religious answers that come up?
Is that actor Kirk Cameron saying that? Did you hear that?
Yeah.
About how God sent the earthquakes to show us humility and that.
So some people will give messages like this: God sends earthquakes to make us humble. God kills people in order to destroys homes, breaks down cities. God does this in order to teach us humility. He's actually representing the thought of a very important theologian in Christian history, which is it's John Calvin, who grows out of another very important thinker, St. Augustine. And this thinking has been in the church for a very long time. And I think you can find some rationale. I think you can find some biblical passages that would support it. Mm-hmm. Okay. What are some other religious ideas? Yeah, Shannon?
Oh, well, this isn't religious, but it's the Earth's response to Donald Trump denying climate change.
Did you hear what she said? This is the Earth responding to Donald Trump for denying climate change, saying, take that. Okay. Yeah, Andy.
Another one is that Hurricane Harvey is a punishment to the United States for people accepting homosexuality as being normal.
And that's why it was placed in San Francisco?
We're not going there.
Okay. Carol, did you want?
Yeah, I can't find it, but I read yesterday that Harvey happened on the 25th, something on the 25th, something on the 28th, and the 29th, and then somebody found a Bible verse that was Luke 25, verses 27 and 28, which corresponded with the dates, and talks about floods rising, and earth shaking, and fire burning, and...
Okay, well, there are two amazing passages. One is Matthew 24, and I think the other one is Luke 21. And at two great chapters where Jesus' disciples are so impressed with the temple. The temple during the time of Jesus overall took 100 years to build and was the largest building in the world, the temple in Jerusalem. And the disciples are just saying, isn't it amazing? Isn't it? And Jesus said, actually, not one stone is going to be left. And what they say to him is, what is the sign of your coming? And what is the sign of the end of the age? And he says, not one stone will be left upon another. But then he does make these uncomfortable comments. You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. There'll be, the earth will quake. The sun will darken. Whoops. there'll be signs in the sky. He makes all of these comments, so over time, over 2,000 years, sometimes people think that those passages are about the end of the world, about just before Jesus comes again. Most New Testament scholars that I've read don't think that. They think that what he's saying is the end of this period of history is coming to a close when this temple is brought down, which happened in 70 AD. In other words, this period of time is coming to a close because of this stubbornness and violence that's inside all of your hearts. I can see where this is going. It's leading to a terrible conclusion. So most New Testament scholars I read say it's not talking about the end of the world. The uncomfortable thing that I've noticed about the Bible is sometimes things have multiple fulfillments. So maybe something gets fulfilled in 70 AD and maybe it has some kind of a fulfillment later. I don't know how these things work. Okay. But that is the third thing that I've clearly heard is some people have said it's punishment from a vengeful God. Some people have said it's a loving God who's trying to teach his people humility. Some people have said it's signs of the end of the world. And can you think of any others? I love the earth slapping Donald. Not Donald Trump, I don't mean that, but I mean but the groups that are strongly involved in fossil fuels. Okay, so lots of talk about God. I don't know why this doesn't work. Yeah? But what do you see, Susan?
I see that this God's way of trying to make us be together and to love each other and to care for each other.
Say it again.
Love each other and care for each other and turn to Him. That's how we look at it.
The way you look at it is it's God's way of trying to get us to love each other and to love Him and to care for each other. I think that's what He always wants. Yeah, that's so beautiful. Andy, I'm not able to make this work for some reason. I don't. Oh, it's working. So these are just the ideas that we've come up with. The assumption behind all of this is that there is a sovereign God who's in control, who has things planned, and He does things that are sometimes, maybe we don't understand His purposes, but this God is a powerful God in control. He intentionally sends hardship our way, whether it's for a reason that you would think bad or whether it's a reason you would think good. This God is doing that thing. I have trouble with this picture myself. I feel like this is one part of the Bible does, especially the early parts, seem to focus on those ideas, but later it seems like they're repudiated. And so, particularly in the Exodus accounts, it seems like that, as the people are leaving Egypt. But you can find a repudiation of this idea in the book of Job and in the words of Jesus. So, for instance, one of the most normal religious ideas in all religions in the world's history is that good people prosper, and if you do well, things will go well for you. And if you don't do well, things won't go well for you. That's a very normal idea in all religions. But it seems as though both in the Old Testament in the book of Job and in the New Testament, specifically in the words of Jesus, it's just absolutely repudiated. It's like, no, it's not that simple. That's not the way it works. There's a level of mystery in the whole thing. You can't figure out, you know. Jesus, some people will say to Jesus, why was this man born blind? Was it his sin or was it his parents' sin? Jesus will say, you're just asking the wrong question. You're asking the completely wrong question. The right question is, what can we do to see the glory of God in this situation? What can we do to let God's beauty come into this situation? Yeah.
I often find that if I'm thinking any of those things in terms of having a hardship myself, I'll think, would my father, my own father, have done any of this intentionally so that I would love him more? I don't think so.
You had a beautiful father. Mm-hmm. You have a beautiful father. Would your father have done these things to you? Yeah. That doesn't look like the father that Jesus is talking about all the time. Would my father have done these things to me too, for whatever reason? Now, sometimes, I don't know if you can admit it on tape anymore, but there were times when I did the dreaded armpit tickle with our children. You know, you know, I'd say, okay, you're really that rebellious? Okay. One, two, three. You might get the dreaded armpit tickle. Does God do that to us? You know, this is the question. So this is what I think is a wiser way to look at it. Personally, this is what I think is wiser. Look what we're doing to our poor planet. Look how we neglect to care for the most vulnerable. You know, look at how in affluent societies and where people can easily get away, like they look even in Florida, when everyone thought that it was going to be Miami that was hit instead of Tampa, what we heard was that the wealthy could easily evacuate, but the homeless couldn't. You know, there's so it's the most vulnerable are the ones that we need to be concerned about. And all around the world, there's so many vulnerable people that live at the lowest levels and are going to be so affected by sea rise, you know. So look how we use science. This is, guess who I got this from? I listened to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Do you know who he is, the astronomer? Sort of America's most beloved astrophysicist these days. He's a brilliant guy, and he said this. Nobody complained, nobody denied when we said that the eclipse was coming. We used exactly the same kind of science to tell us that climate change is happening because of us. Why do we deny that? And the very clear thought is we deny it because we don't want to give up present gain for future pain. Right? I mean, we're willing to let others suffer in the future because we don't want to give up our present gain. We have societies that run on fossil fuels, and so we'll do anything to protect, including even convince ourselves that that we're not hurting the earth. You know? That's what I think. Okay. I'm not an expert, I don't know. But that's what I think. This is what he said. When we use the same tools to talk about climate change, people, many of whom profit from fossil fuel industries, deny this. It feels a lot like tobacco to me. You know, we knew that tobacco hurt people way longer, for a very long time we knew that it hurt. But people that made their money in tobacco did everything they could not to believe it. You know, we were on a plane once when our kids were little and we were going out to see my parents on the West Coast. And there was this nice lady sitting beside us and we were so afraid that our kids would be too noisy and we were talking to her, you know. And she ended up being so, so nice. And then finally, she just started breaking her heart open and talking to us. She said, I come from a family on the East Coast of the United States and we're a very wealthy family. And we made all of our money in tobacco. And she said, I can hardly live with it now when I think about it. You know, so it's such an interesting, you know, it's so hard. I know we had a lady visit here who works in Hong Kong with heroin addicts. Her name is Jackie Pullinger, and Jackie Pullinger Ta. And she needed when Hong Kong was being given back from British rule back to China in 1997, the Chinese government said to her, "We know that you're a Christian ministry, but you are the only one we know that can work effectively with heroin addicts. So we would like to give you a piece of land for you to continue your work," and the land was worth millions, you know. And they said, but you would have to raise the money to raise the buildings and everything. And they said, "How much time would you like to do it?" She said, 3 months. And some of you know Gary Best, who lived here, Gary and Joy. Gary's a very good friend of Jackie's. And he said, this is exactly what happened. The authorities in Hong Kong said, "How much time would you like to raise?" I think she had to raise $6 million. And she said, 3 months. And they said, "No, we were thinking of a couple of years." And she said, "No, it would be too much pressure for too long. I'd rather just do it." And so she ends up, and she has no money. She just has friends, and she has prayer. And so she starts to pray, and she made a beautiful brochure asking for help. And Gary looked at it and said, "Yes, perfect." And then she said, "I can't use it. I'd rather just leave it in God's hands." I mean, she's this kind of person. And so anyway, she prayed. And the last weekend when the money had to come in, and it looked like they were going to lose everything, a family in Britain that had made all their money through the opium trade, the eldest son heard about this He cashed in his shares and he sent it back. You know, it's just, the money arrives at the right moment. It's just incredible. Oh, anyway. So, I don't know where I was going there. What can we do when things go wrong? What can we do when there are disasters? What can we do when things get bad? Well, in the Old Testament, I love the story of Joseph. Remember the guy with the many-colored coat? Remember it from Sunday school? He's sort of his father's favorite. He's a bit of a tattletale. The other brothers don't like him. They get a chance. They throw him in a pit. Finally, they sell him into slavery. He gets falsely accused of a sexual crime. He gets thrown in prison. He gets forgotten there. I mean, really, a lot of things go wrong in the guy's life. It's like bad to worse to worse to worse. And what happens is, through it all, he just seems to grow. He becomes a better human. He becomes more mature. He becomes quietly confident in who he is and who God is with him. And you really see that in the latter part of the story. It's like everything that goes wrong also provided an opportunity for him to grow. And at the end, you see a couple of things that are just so special. One is what he calls his children. I'll go there in a second. And the other is his forgiveness for his brothers, the ones who hurt him the most. And another is just the character that develops in the man. And then he recognizes that God is a genius at bringing good results from difficult times. So let me show you these passages. This is his children's names. Before the years of famine came, Joseph had two sons. He marries the daughter of the high priest and in Egypt. And Joseph names the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. And the second he named Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my misfortunes. Isn't that like the one is looking back and the other is saying fruitful now. So the one is, God has made me to forget all the painful things I've been through. You know, and now God has made me fruitful in the land that resulted from that place. If you could walk through life with that kind of a peace in the past for the emotional baggage that you carry and strength in the present and future, wouldn't that be good? Yeah. And I love this passage, the very last part of the book of Genesis, the first book of the Old Testament. The brothers come to him and they say, our father has died now. And we're terrified. They're actually terrified that now that the father is dead, he will take revenge. And they come and they say, just before dad died, he said, please, please forgive us for what we did to you, throwing you in a pit, selling you into slavery. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brothers also wept. And they said, we're here as your slaves. And Joseph said, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he's doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones. In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. I've always loved this story of Joseph. Personally, I think he's one of the best characters that prefigures Jesus. And there's so many aspects of his life that does this, but he's the only guy that I could find in the Old Testament who weeps and then says, be not afraid. And that's what Jesus says too. Weeps and says, be not afraid. And then the meaning of what happened, what he says to his brothers is exactly what Jesus would say to the whole world. You know, it's, don't be afraid. Well, am I in the place of God? That could be a little bit ironic if it was Jesus. Even though you intended to do harm to me, God is working good through it in order to preserve a numerous people as he's doing today. So have no fear. You know, even though you guys had a bad intent, you treated me terribly, look, everything worked out, and I've come to peace with the past, and I'm fruitful in the right now. Go and do likewise. Okay. Now, in the New Testament, in the very chapter, Matthew 24, that speaks of all the disasters, there's this interesting parable at the bottom. Jesus says this, who then is the faithful and wise servant, or slave, could be either word, the word's the same, whom his master has put in charge of his household to give the other slaves their allowance of food at the proper time. Blessed is that slave whom his master will find at work when he arrives. Truly, I tell you, he'll put that one in charge of all his possessions. But if the wicked slave says to himself, my master's delayed, and he begins to beat his fellow slaves, he eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he doesn't expect him, and in an hour that he doesn't know, he'll cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites where they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. To me, it really means don't price gouge in a flood. Like, don't take advantage of people that are hurting. Like, did you hear that some people were selling bottles of water for $90 in Houston at convenience stores? Like, come on. To me, that looks like God doesn't like that. And instead, he is thrilled with people who, no matter what's going on, just faithfully care for others. So when you hear some of the religious voices on the internet, some of them are saying, go and repent, get ready to meet your God, that sort of thing, I would say, I will do whatever you want, but I would say, that's not the message. The message is just keep caring for the people around you. Just keep loving people. Because that's what seems to delight the heart of God. Who's the faithful and wise servant whom his master has put in charge, who just keeps caring for the people around him? Blessed is that one. I'm telling you, God's going to just lift him up. You keep caring for others, God is going to lift you up. So here's my conclusion. It's not working again. I don't know why. Can you push it forward, Andy? There's always an opportunity to do good to others, even if disasters are going on, or even if they're not. There's always a chance to do good. This pleases God so much. Taking advantage of people in pain is a little lower on his list. He's not crazy about that. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, I have two weird things to finish this service with. One, and they both happen by accidental timing. One is a little interview that I happened to see that really impressed me. I've watched it two or three times now. And so I'm going to show you an interview of one of my favorite late night hosts is Trevor Noah. And I love his perspective on things sometimes. But he is interviewing a young climate change activist who's 17 years old. So I wanted to show you this. I think it's a very interesting interview. And then after that, I want to show you something which just came after I finished this whole sermon. One of the people who is dearest to me, who doesn't think as I do about things, in fact, if I default to the left, he defaults to the right, he saw something funny on the internet that he thought I would appreciate, so he sent it to me. And we had the most wonderful conversation afterwards. So I'm going to show you a little, something that's very serious, and then something that's a little lighter, if it all works. I'm not trying to make crazy political statements. I'm just trying to show you. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this. If you appreciate this perspective, you probably enjoy this. If you don't appreciate this perspective, I think you can still find things here to like. Let's go.
Please welcome Chantel Scott Martinez.
Pleasure to be here, man.
You are a young man doing amazing things, and you have been working hard at this for a very long time. If you ask most people when they got into working to help with climate change, they would be like, they haven't started. You started when you were 6?
Yeah, I could probably barely see over this table.
Like, how does that start? I know you talk about it in the book, and your mom was really someone who was passionate about, you know, fighting for the environment. But what are you doing at 6? Is that you go like, yeah, this is what I'm gonna do. Legos are not for me, man.
Really, I play with Legos so much. I took myself really seriously when I was little. You know, I saw a documentary about the destruction of the planet. I was like, this is my destiny.
Right.
And I was really like terrified by the thought that my future was gonna be tainted because people all over the world weren't taking adequate action to protect us from climate disaster. And that inspired me to do something about it. I told mom I need to talk to people, help me. You know, so right. She became my publicist and my manager and my agent, age 6. You know, so that was pretty dope. And I evolved in sense that this has been, you know, more opportunities to use my voice to make a difference in the world. It's been quite the journey.
You've really been working hard at this. You're not just speaking about it, but you're an activist.
Mm.
You went on to take over from your sister fighting against threats to global warming and climate change in Colorado at the age of 9. Please explain to me how you take over any operation that doesn't involve cookies at the age of 9.
We got involved with this organization called Earth Guardians that my mom started it as an accredited high school in Maui, Hawaii. My sister was running it. She passed it on to me when I was like 9. Me and my friends went into our local county commissioners and we banned the use of pesticides. We continued to work in our community to ban fracking for 5 years.
Let's back up, because you just said you were 9, and then you went into offices and you got them to ban using pesticides.
Yeah.
Like, how do you even begin this as a 9-year-old?
It was a whole squad of us, man. We mobbed them, you know?
No, a squad of 9-year-olds?
Yeah, there was about maybe 10 of us that spoke at a press conference, and then we went in and we gave our testaments, our speeches as to why we didn't think that was a good, healthy option for our community. Yeah.
And you're writing speeches about this at the age of 9, a squad of 9. Where do you find the other 9-year-olds?
You know, I think that young people all over this country, more than we give them credit for, are actually really interested in being engaged. They don't really have a platform. I was really lucky to have a supportive family and community, so we just reached out to these youth that did care, and all of a sudden we were all over.
You talk about that in the book as well, which I really appreciate, because in many ways this is like an activist guy. Yeah, you know, you talk about mobilizing, you talk about getting out there, you talk about spreading the message, you talk about doing, which is really important. You know, you're optimistic, but you're a doer as well. There's a quote in the book that really stuck with me, and that was, speaking about how we may be in a really horrible time right now, but this generation has the opportunity to rewrite history. What do you mean by that?
I think that now more than ever, we have an opportunity to reapproach an issue like climate change, where it's traditionally been seen as like politicians and activists care about this issue, but truly it's so much bigger than that. If you see the thousands of lives that are being lost across South Asia, Africa, the Middle East due to floods, you know, Hurricane Irma that is now brewing, Hurricane Harvey that hit Texas,
right.
You know, it's about people's lives, it's about people's families, their homes, their community. That is the issue we are facing. And as a member of the younger generation, I believe that we have this opportunity now to face this crisis and to change the way we are acting, and we are doing something about it. I'm in a lawsuit against the federal government, suing the Trump administration for violating our constitutional rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness, for failing to act on climate change. We are changing the way that we are taking action. We are getting artistic. We are moving into the streets in a way we have never seen. So now this generation is reshaping the way that we address an issue as big as climate change. It is, we're not going to allow this era to be defined by Donald Trump.
Wow.
Yeah.
So just so we're on the same page, you just said you're going to sue Donald Trump. You're suing him right now, which, I mean, that's pretty, like, asshole-ish of you. I'm just gonna put out there. Suing is his thing, and you, like, that's like going up against Daenerys with her dragons. That's like going up, like, that's pretty mean. What do you hope to achieve with this? Do you actually hope that he'll see his day in court?
So, myself and 20 other young people are actually already plaintiffs in the lawsuit that has been in place since 2015 against the Obama administration, and then transferred over to Trump when he was elected, which we were kind of stoked about. Like, it was way more satisfying to say we're suing Trump than what it takes. We believe that our federal government is violating our constitutional rights.
Right.
They are infringing upon our rights by colluding with the fossil fuel industry to create this crisis, supporting the very industries that are creating climate change. So it's February 5th, we actually have our date in trial. So there was motions to dismiss that were filed from the most powerful government, or one of the most powerful governments on the planet, and the fossil fuel industry. They were trying to get our lawsuit thrown out of court. After two different judges reviewed this motion to dismiss, they said we do have the right to take this to trial. So February 5th is our trial date. We are hoping that the what will happen is that the courts will force the federal government to enforce massive climate recovery plans that have been put together by the top climate scientists in the world to reduce our greenhouse gas footprint as a nation back down to a safe level for our generation.
You just made me feel like the biggest underachiever ever, man.
So I don't know that, you know, how you think about every part of that, but it is impressive somebody wanting to actually get involved and to, you know, a 17-year-old, I felt like an underachiever too when I looked at that. That's how I felt when I looked at Wayne Gretzky's career. So I've got one more thing to show, and this is the thing that's lighter, and this, just as I said, this was kind of a gift. I finished all of this is where I thought we were gonna end, and then my friend, who would not think this way, sent this to me because he knew he thought it was funny, and he knew that I would like it. So then we had a wonderful talk about it afterwards. So it's just, I don't know if you will all get it, because some of you will get it, and it has a little bit to do with how old you are.
Yeah. Can you get the sound up?
It's time for him to tweet again. But first he'll have to check in with Fox News, cause that's the only place he gets his views. And that's how things get planted. The problem is he's not alone. He talks to people on his phone. Now the whole morning is a giant hoax, perpetuated by a liberal force. And he hires people who think they're the same, that play his game. When he talks to crowds of four, he sees them bouncing back. Believing they all that he's on earth, and was the product of virgin birth. And if you disagree, fools as he who do not know, it makes me smile from so much low. I know exactly where the problems are, but his solutions are beyond the song.
Phoned me right away and said, what are you going to say? And I said, I'm going to say that I don't know what all of these things mean, but I know that in every situation we have the chance to grow, to develop character, to become more like Christ, and to care for those around us. Always. That's what we always have, whether there's disasters or whether there's not disasters. Okay. So, Jesus, please give us the strength to do this. Amen. Goodbye. Thank you.